Right. Well, we're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 28 this morning. This is a rather odd story. You probably have all heard of it, but it is a little bit peculiar in terms of the content. This is where Saul visits the witch of Endor. And I don't know if George Lucas got the name Endor from this passage of the Old Testament, but Endor, most people think of Star Wars. But
what was the mother's name on the witch? Endora.
Endora. Wow. There you go.
Satanic show. Right there.
So, this, though, of course, is Endor, a city in Israel that is occupied by many Philistines at the time. And Saul is going to visit this witch for a very strange mission, but he wants to speak with Samuel's ghost. So let's begin with 1 Samuel 28. It happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war, to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, "You assuredly know that you will go out with me to battle, you and your men." And David said to Achish, "Surely you know what your servant can do." And Achish said to David, "Therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever." Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had lamented for him, and buried him in Ramah, his own city. Saul had put the mediums and spiritists out of the land. And then the Philistines gathered together and came and encamped at Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa. But when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. So there's a fair amount of context to introducing this story. We mentioned some of this last week. The Philistines are going to war against Israel. David is not going to fight with them against Israel, but at this point, it looks like he is. And Saul would have been justified in assuming that not only is he going to have to fight the bad guys, but he's going to have to fight David and all of the soldiers with him. And so that is one reason Saul is scared and desperate, but also now Samuel has died. And even though Saul and Samuel might not have been on the best terms all the time, Samuel still is an important spiritual figure in the life of Israel. He would have been someone that Saul would have still needed to call upon and work with and ask for divine guidance. But Samuel is dead, and all of Israel is mourning him. They know David is gone, and so it's all down to Saul. Can he defend the people against all the odds? And he is anxious and scared. His heart trembled greatly. And look at verse 6. When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, neither by dreams, or by Urim, or by the prophets. So when Saul wants to find special revelation from God, the same sort of thing, of course, that David had been successful in finding, and we are, I believe, to understand that Samuel would have been able to assist in this as well had he still been alive, but Saul is striking out. He is not getting any dreams, which means that sometimes people got dreams of divine guidance. The Urim, which is part of the ephod, the Urim and the Thurim, it is not giving him any information. And no prophets are speaking to Saul, so he is desperate. And he decides to find a witch or a medium. Saul said to his servants, "Find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her."
So now, is he looking for specific tactics? I mean, is that what he's wanting?
He wants, we'll see what he wants. He wants to talk to Samuel. And so he wants that. He wants to talk to Samuel, so Samuel will talk to God and give him information to fight David. Now, I guess you mean, is he looking for, battle plans and stuff?
Well, because, my Bible references the original anointing of him by Samuel. And it's almost sort of like he just wants to hear it again that he's the guy that's going to save Israel from
confirmation. Yeah. So I think he's just completely desperate, you know, that he doesn't have any game plan anymore. Everyone he would have relied on is gone. So he's just trying to get some help. Whether it's tactics, whether it's special information not to go, or something to tell the people, you know, to rally them. It's could be any of those. Now, this word medium is a little bit of an unusual word. We don't use it too much today, except there was a TV show recently by that name. I never watched it. But it really does mean in between, in the middle. But it's in the middle of life and death. Someone who stands at the boundary of this world and the next. And they can communicate with the dead. Now, this was, of course, a violation of Torah. The Old Testament Mosaic law had forbid necromancy, speaking with the dead, and any sort of witchcraft and sorcery. And apparently, in the early stages of Saul's kingship, he was faithful to that prohibition. That's why we are told Saul had put the mediums and spiritists out of the land. One thing also to mention here is that these were more or less real sorcerers and sorceresses. I think it's very important that we don't just say, well, they were old, ancient times, they were confused, they weren't ever really doing anything, they just thought they were. That's sort of the modern way to explain this. But we all know witchcraft is impossible. Well, in the Old Testament, it certainly seems to have been possible. Why would you make laws against things that were impossible? Why would you go to such great lengths to exterminate all of these people from the land? And then why are you now going to seek them out? And so I think these were more or less real witches and wizards, or whatever we wish to call them. Now, how did it work? Probably demonic spirits. I don't think that the self-identification and understanding of the witches was correct. They would have said that they were, you know, some special shaman who was hooked up to this god or that god. Probably because we know that the false gods are demons, that this is a demonic activity, but something was going on. That's my point. There was something real about this. And Saul decides that he's going to go make use of these spiritual counselors, even though he knows it's wrong. He knows it's sinful. He himself has kicked them out already, so there's no way of thinking that he is uninformed. He knows this is wrong, but he's that desperate, and he's just going, I think, crazy. I think Saul has degenerated to about the lowest point here. So he needs someone to get information from God for him. Find a woman who is a medium, that I may go and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, in fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor. Perhaps she was well known. Perhaps she had something of a big business here. Endor would have been hostile territory at the time. It would have been in the Canaanite, Philistine-occupied areas, and so that's where she is able to do her arts. And Saul disguised himself, put on other clothes, and he went, and two men with him. And they came to the woman by night and said, and this translation is a little bit odd, mine says, please conduct a seance for me and bring up for me the one I shall name to you. Seance is sort of what it's a modern word. It's not the original word they would have used. In fact, the word in Hebrew for medium is actually woman with a ritual pit. It's a little bit awkward, right? So you have to know what the ritual pit is for. It's for communicating with spirits. And when he says, have a seance for me, he says, use your ritual pit, or use your, we might say, cauldron, to bring up a spirit. There were small ones, diviner's cups, just a little cup, and then there were big giant things, but there were some sort of water container that they would use to communicate with spirits. And when he says, bring me someone up, the idea is from the grave. They're dead, bring them up, and let me communicate with them. And the woman says, look, you know what Saul has done. So she doesn't know who she's speaking with. How he has cut off the mediums and spiritists from the land. Why do you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die? So she wants him to be sure of the stakes. If you're asking me to do this thing, this is highly illegal. This would be a capital offense. And so the implication is, of course, you can't tell anybody, and you better make it worth my while. And Saul said, swore to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Now, this is doubly sinful on his part. First of all, Saul shouldn't be asking her to do this thing anyway. But now he's swearing by the Lord that he will protect her for violating God's law. And so this, I think, would be an example of Saul taking the Lord's name in vain as well. Because, you know, you're swearing by the Lord to protect someone who you're asking to break the Lord's commandments.
As if God isn't going to see it.
Right. Yeah, right. Like, I don't worry about it. I'll protect you from God. It's just, it shows you the state of Saul's corruption at this point. And so the woman says, whom shall I bring up for you? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. Bring up Samuel for me. And so she does. And what's interesting is, as soon as she brings up Samuel or sees Samuel, she also realizes that she's dealing with Saul. So there's something happening here. The light bulb goes on. She goes, whoa, uh-oh. And many commentators will say that this was the first time that she had ever been able to do exactly what she promised. You know, a lot of times these sorcerers and sorceresses will make very generic promises, right? I will find some information for you. I will speak with something. But for her to actually get Samuel right away, whoa, okay, something's different. But it may also have been the case that she just realizes that she's not really in control. She got more than she was really bargaining for, because now not only is Samuel here, but she's got this new information, like, oh, and I'm dealing with Saul now, and he's not going to do what I want him to do.
So she didn't know. Saul went to her in disguise, yep, just not to hide himself from anybody who might see him. He was disguising himself from her, so she didn't even...
Probably both. I think he doesn't want to be seen, but also it'd be like a cop going to a drug dealer, right? She wouldn't have done it because he's the guy who just ran them all out of the land. So he's got to pretend that he's not Saul to get her to cooperate. But now she realizes, whoa, why have you deceived me? You are Saul. And the king said to her, do not be afraid. What did you see? And the woman said to Saul, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth. So it's coming up. The word for spirit here is actually Elohim, which is a word that is sometimes used to mean God, but it's also a word that means angels. It sometimes means spiritual powers. Sometimes it means kings. And so translating as spirit is just the English way to let us know that it's not God, but it's some sort of ghostly, God-like entity. And Saul said to her, what is his form? So Saul doesn't see it, actually, at least not right away. She is the one that he has to work with to get to this ghost. And she describes the form, and that's how Saul knows it's Samuel. An old man is coming up, and he is covered with a mantle. The mantle is a common piece of garment that the prophets wear. You know, Elijah has a mantle he gives to Elisha. And so Samuel has this mantle would be wrapped around his face, perhaps, or his shoulders. And so when she describes Samuel in that way, Saul knows that it is Samuel. And he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed down. Now, this is interesting because apparently spirits have some likeness to their bodily counterparts. It's always a question, right? Well, how would you recognize the spirit? Is it translucent? I don't know. It has some form. It's a ghostly form, but it's at least enough that you can see that it is Samuel. And Saul is convinced that it is Samuel, so he bows down to the ground. Now, there is a big debate here historically. Is this for real? Is this really Samuel? What's going on? Now, modern commentators, by and large, are of two schools. There is the liberal school that says this is all just some story. None of it was really real. And, you know, they thought something weird happened, but we know it didn't. So that's sort of just the liberal explanation. The modern conservative position, by and large, almost every modern conservative commentator I've read says, yeah, it was real. This was Samuel's ghost, and, you know, it's odd that it happened, but it happened. But that's really not true when we go back in history. And I was surprised to see this. I think, hold to the modern conservative view, but the older view, by and large, says this is not really Samuel. And it's kind of curious. They say that this is a demonic imposter, and that is part of the judgment against Saul. And the argument is that God wouldn't have cooperated with this sort of thing. You know, he wouldn't have allowed a pagan witch to bring up Samuel. He just would have intervened and stopped it. And that Samuel himself would not have wanted to go along with it. There's also the certain readings of 1 Chronicles 10, 13 through 14 could be construed to read that Saul spoke with a false spirit. There's a debate over how to translate that. But if you look at 1 Chronicles 10, verse 13 and 14, Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. Well, in that verse, actually, in Hebrew, it doesn't say medium. It says spirit. And so, and then 14, he did not inquire of the Lord. And so some people take that verse to mean that Saul was speaking to a demon. He's speaking to a false spirit, not of the Lord. Now, I think that might be one way to read it. I certainly don't think that that's the obvious only way that that verse can be read, but that's the case for saying this wasn't Samuel, this was a demon. God wouldn't do it, it's a violation of his law, and Chronicles says that Saul spoke with a spirit, not from the Lord.
What's a violation of his law?
That you can't use necromancers and sorcerers.
But
that
like what people do.
Well, right, but
he hasn't prevented all the
Well, the argument is that he wouldn't have allowed a sorcerer to bring Samuel up, right?
She would.
Yeah, because the sorcerers ordinarily are tapping into demons, and so God is not going to have the saints, you know, at the beck and call of demons. That would be the argument.
Unless he wishes that to do.
Well, we'll get there. We'll get there. Hold on. So, but the thing to notice, though, is this is the view of most of the rabbis, the Jews, all of the patristics, almost all of the medievals, and all of the reformers. Okay, so before we say that's outrageous, that's so stupid. I mean, that was the majority position. The one big exception is Josephus, who's an early Jewish commentator writing in the first century. He took it literally. He said, no, yep, that was Samuel. That's what happened. And he didn't have any problem with it. So it's not that ancient people couldn't take it literally. It's just most of them had moral qualms.
It wasn't that they thought nothing happened that was made up. Like
they thought it was a demon. That's right. They thought it's like at the end of Narnia when they're calling up Tash and then they finally get him. You know, like, wait a minute, we didn't know we were really going to get him. You know, this witch, you know, is calling on demons, and so she gets one. And it's pretending to be Samuel, but of course it's pretending to be Samuel in this view in order to condemn Saul, not to bless him. So the majority tradition historically says this is not really Samuel. It's a demon posing as Samuel, all as part of the judgment against Saul. Now, most modern conservative commentators tend to take this literally, and I do think it's probably 90-95%. So there's been a pretty dramatic shift in the readings, and this is the way that I read it right now. I'm probably not going to die over either position, but this is the way that seems most natural to me, is that it is Samuel. Verse 14 of 1 Samuel 28, obviously, he's describing Samuel. Looks like Samuel, and Saul says, that's Samuel. The text here refers to him as Samuel. I think that's really important. It doesn't say a spirit pretending to be Samuel. It says Samuel. And so had the author here wanted us to know it's not really Samuel, they didn't do a very good job of letting us know that. It certainly sounds like it's Samuel. It talks like Samuel. By which I mean the character called Samuel's ghost here references things the historical Samuel said earlier in the book, and he says that it was his stuff. Verse 17 and 19, the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me. For the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Well, earlier in the book of 1 Samuel, Samuel, while still alive, goes to Saul and says, you need to kill Amalek and all the Amalekites. And Saul doesn't do it. And Samuel says that you're now going to be judged for this. So the ghost of Samuel is quoting Samuel from earlier and saying that that was me. So I think the on-the-face reading of this chapter would say it is Samuel's ghost. That's weird. That's very unusual, and God is not saying that you ought to try to talk to people's ghosts. But on this occasion, he allowed Saul to do this in order to judge him. Saul is hoping Samuel is going to give him some sort of blessing or good word, some sort of encouragement, something to help the Israelites in this battle they're about to face. But in fact, Samuel's ghost pronounces judgment against Saul. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" And Saul answered, "I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I called you, that you may reveal to me what I should do. Tell me what to do. Do I fight? Do I not fight? Do I do something else? How do we get this ship righted?" And Samuel says, "Why do you ask me, seeing that the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? The Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me." And that's where he repeats the judgment. "The Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hands of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." And that means dead, in the grave. "The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines." And so this spirit pronounces doom on Saul, judgment. And this judgment is going to come true in chapter 31. This battle that Saul goes into is his last. He is killed by these Philistines, and he will die.
Stephen,
yes.
Do you see that as more as a piece of evidence that this was not a demonic deception, because the prophecy was true?
It happened. I think that that gives it more consistency by saying that God worked with this to reveal truth, even though it's negative truth. It's judgment. I think
he didn't get what he wanted. He got judgment.
Yeah, either way would be God's judgment, but this way is sort of like God gives him an answer, right? He asks, he gets his answer. The other way is that God doesn't answer, but some other demon answers
and
instead.
And answers the way God would want him to answer, which is weird.
Right? Yeah, though, that's not entirely, you know, unheard of. I mean, when Jesus excommunicates demons, they often speak truth.
Yeah.
So,
it spoke like Samuel would probably have
spoken. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be consistent with the position that this is Samuel. So
I have one little piece of information from Luke. Lazarus and the rich man.
Uh-huh.
Lazarus is in, no, the rich man's in hell, looking up, looking all the way to heaven,
mm-hmm.
and sees Abraham with Lazarus, the poor beggar. And besides that he had all the prophets to tell him, there is also a fixed gulf between us and those, and you can't go down, and you can't come up, and you can't visit each other. Now that's between not earth and heaven, but hell and heaven, mm-hmm. which may be very different. all the geography there, for sure.
It says the Spirit ascended out of the earth.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the Old Testament, the direction is always down.
Well,
and that raises
a gulf. So what does that mean?
It raises an interesting question. Everybody goes down in the Old Testament. They all go down. Jacob says, "You're bringing my hoary hair down to Sheol." David in all the Psalms says, "You will not leave me in Sheol." And so I think this is one thing that we have to work through. In the Sheol means the grave or the underworld. And so it seems that everybody went down, quote unquote. And there was a place for the good and a place for the bad, even though it was all down. And it's in the New Testament when Jesus ascends to heaven that then the saints follow him. In Ephesians it says that when he ascended, he led captivity captive. And so there's this idea that Jesus is really the first man to go up into God's, you know, courtroom like we think of it today, and he brings the people with him. Now that's highly contested as to how all of that works. There's a tradition in the English tradition that, you know, Jesus goes down to the underworld, he breaks in, you know, kicks the door down, grabs the good guys, and gets out of there. That's all a little bit fanciful, of course, but it seems that something like that's going on, that in the Old Testament everything is down, and after Jesus ascends, then you get people who are united to Jesus ascending as well, and people who are not going down again. But it's a little unclear. It's not like the Bible gives us a direct answer to some of these questions. But either good or bad in the Old Testament, you could use that language of going down and coming up.
In terms of spirits having a shape or some connection to the body, I mean, we have another example of this when on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Yep.
We have Moses and Elijah showing up in a recognizable form.
That's right.
Although they had not been bodily resurrected as far as we know.
Right. That's right. Yeah, then they come back sort of in a spiritual state, but you can recognize them, absolutely. So there's something to that possibility, even though it's odd.
Matthew Henry thought it was really Samuel.
Okay.
So
the questions are all like, sort of, we know what it means. It means Saul is judged. Saul, he goes to get a word from God, and he doesn't get what he wants. He gets judgment. And even Samuel himself is participating, or if this is Samuel, participating in this judgment. And this is it. This is curtains for Saul. It's over. He falls down on the ground, is dreadfully afraid. There was no strength in him. He refuses to eat. And then the witch and her servants force him to eat. Finally they do, and they leave. And this is the final nail in his coffin. 1 Chronicles 10, again, makes it clear he was judged for this act as well. So the basic meaning is clear. Saul has fallen all the way to the bottom of spiritual sanity. He is at his wit's end, and he's trying to get help anywhere he can get it, and he's not getting it anywhere. But most of our questions are sort of, what in the world was going on with this witch? How did that happen? And I think we can say, at the very least, she wasn't able to conjure up Samuel because she was a good witch, right? She was skilled at the black arts, and she knew how to do it. No, I think she would have been would have failed in this endeavor had God not agreed to go along with it for the purpose of pronouncing judgment. And I think her reaction of surprise confirms that. She's like, whoa, it worked. You know, it is Samuel. Maybe she was going to get somebody else. Maybe she was going to get some generic spirit or something. But when she gets Samuel, she's, whoa, what's going on here? This is different. And God is using her to give Saul what he asked for. And this is a theme in the Old Testament and in the New, but you get what you ask for. It's either good or bad, but you get it. And so if you want sin, God will give you over to the sin. And if you want something you think is good, but by illicit means, he might give it to you, but you will discover that it is not good. And so this is what's happening here. Saul gets his request, but it is not what he had hoped it would be. So, does witchcraft exist? That's a question a lot of people ask. Well, it's certainly something like it, certainly used to, at least. There are lots of people who think that it has ceased to function now. That was a popular position of the early church, is that Jesus put an end to it when he triumphed over the powers and principalities of the air. And so you get that in a lot of the church fathers. And in, actually, Thomas Aquinas, so he's Middle Ages, he actually says it would be wrong to have witch trials anymore because we just know they're done. They're not even around anymore. So it is a curious sort of how the tradition changes because, of course, a couple hundred years later, witchcraft trials are back. You know, they're all the rage. So the history of belief in witchcraft is up and down. It's not a... The liberal narrative is, well, they were all stupid back then. They believed it. Now we know better. That's not really how it happened. Historically, there was belief, and then it kind of went away, and it kind of came back. So something existed where people worked with spirits and had things happening, and that's universally testified. I mean, whatever they choose to call it, every world culture has some notion of a person who talks with a deity or talks with spirits. And God, of course, condemns it and outlaws it in Israel. And so, again, why would you have to make laws about something that doesn't exist? Why not just tell people it doesn't exist? But it is condemned by God. And whatever Saul was trying to do, something, in fact, happened. You know, he got something out of it. It was judgment. Does witchcraft exist today? Well, this story doesn't tell us. So I think that's the first thing to be to say. Whatever our answer is, this story isn't going to give us that answer because this is a highly unusual story. The story is in the Old Testament. It's in a time of war. God is pronouncing judgment on Saul to give the kingdom to David. So this would not be a kind of story that we could just imitate today. There's nothing about this story, really, that would be transferable to our context because of all the changes in covenant history. But the fact that Saul is judged for it, it's considered a great sin, I think is pretty good evidence not to try, not to go for it again. And I think another thing that's important here is Saul actually isn't trying to speak with a demon. He isn't asking to speak with a demon. He's not asking to speak with another god. He's asking to speak with the saints departed. And so this is a very relevant text for Protestant position of not communicating with the saints. The Catholic Church, sometimes we reduce their position to a very simple thing. You know, they think they can talk to dead people. Well, yes, but they have a whole argument for why that's possible. They'll say we're all alive in Christ, the communion of the saints through the Holy Spirit unites us together, so we can communicate with them and ask them to do spiritual things for us. You know, they're not asking for fortune-telling necessarily, though you probably see that on a folk level. But in this passage, Saul is trying to speak to a righteous prophet who has gone to the next world. And so I think all of the Catholic arguments for prayers to the saints would have been at Saul's disposal to justify what he's doing here, right? I am trying to talk with someone I'm united with spiritually, who's now in heaven, now with God, and I'm asking them to help me in a spiritual way. And this is condemned. This is no way. Can't do it. Yes?
I think the Catholic response to that being condemning of their position is that it's clear that Saul's doing it in such a way that he knows he's wrong because he goes to the pagan and he is. Whereas if Saul had just gotten down on his knees and prayed to heaven, he would say, come and help me, but that would have been okay.
That would have been okay.
But he didn't do that. He wanted to conjure the Spirit to actually come, but his wish in the communion of the saints. And so, what's our response to say it's still the same thing?
Well, I think the first thing is Samuel says, "Why have you called me?" So, you know, had Saul been calling and calling and calling and none of that worked, that would be an odd, you know, what do you want? Why are you calling me? You know, why have you disturbed me? That sort of seems to me that this is the first time that they're communicating to one another. I think the other thing is, you don't ever see anyone ever in the Old Testament communicating to a faithful saint departed, ever. I mean, this is the only time it ever happens, and it's bad. And of course, in the law, it doesn't only say, don't go to sorcerers. It says, don't communicate with the dead. It says, you know, necromancers shall be put to death. That's the way the law is worded. So, you know, it's pretty universal at that point.
In the Catholic Church, as far as a mediator between God and man, are the saints seen as that in addition to Mary?
Yes, they have a hierarchy, yep. Yeah. And so, you know, Jesus at the top, and then Mary's right under him, and then the better saints, and it kind of goes all the way down.
What you just explained to me is me asking St. Thomas to pray for me is the same as me asking you to pray for me. Or they're all the saints, and we're all asking for accessory prayer on our behalf. And you're asking
and of course, the way that fails is, well, then why is St. Thomas super famous and you're carrying around statues of him, right? I mean, if it's just like asking...
Because he's better.
It's just like asking me to pray, then why don't you ask me to pray, right?
Well, it's St. Thomas.
Right, because you haven't been beatified.
Right, I haven't been... Yeah, I'm not a saint.
What I'm asking for is, do they have any sense that the priest helps them contact the saint in any way? In that the priest is acting as a medium?
Yeah, I doubt that. On paper, I would say probably no. There's no, but on you know, a lay level, they certainly do think the holier people are going to be more successful at getting a response.
But they do. Like when I went and spoke at St. Joe 3 or 4 years ago, and I'm sitting there in like a, you know, it was like a forum, it was a pro-life forum, and we're all sitting there. And all of a sudden, the woman stands up, just like you would open any kind of thing, and she goes, "Dear St. Anthony." And prays just like we would say, "Dear God," and just says this prayer that was just like we pray to St. Anthony the exact same way that we would pray to God.
And that's always been part of the Protestant stance, is that even if all of this explanation worked, which we don't think it does, it would still be a terrible idea, because you would be asking for idolatry to happen on a base lay level all the time. You're setting people up for this. So, and you know, so I think that's right. I mean, at the end of the, it's sort of like the distinction they'll make, well, it's not worship, it's hyperdulia, which means super service. Well, you're still bowing, you're still putting your head down, you're still doing acts of devotion towards this thing. It, you know, it looks like worship, it quacks like worship, it's worship. Yeah. And so this is a famous passage to condemn all attempts at spiritualism, speaking to spirits, whether good or bad. We are not to do it. We are to be content with what God has revealed to us, and if we would make faithful use of all the ordinary means, we would never find ourselves in such a situation, of course. Saul is here because of his continued sin.
And he talked to Sam, like, he would have, if he had been paying attention,
right,
he should have known what Samuel was going to tell him.
Sure.
Anyway, Samuel would have been like, you're messing up, dude.
Yeah.
You know, the Lord's not on your side anymore.
Well, and that's, you know, the rich man and Lazarus, that comes up in the New Testament. Send, you know, go back, send Moses back, send somebody back. And he says,
I did.
Yeah, you had your chance. They were there, they were talking to you, and you rejected them. And so, no. And why would you think they would listen to him now? Now Saul still goes to battle. You know, he doesn't have an option to not go, so he's going to go, and that'll be what we'll talk about next time, but Samuel's prophecy will come true.
What's our appropriate attitude towards witches in our culture?
Explain more. Like,
well, I mean, dressing up as a witch, watching Wizard of Oz, reading Harry Potter.
Right.
I mean, we've got them everywhere.
Yeah, I think that it's one of those things where you ought not, we ought not to really dabble in any witchcraft. So, you know, people that are thinking that Ouija boards and whatnot are legit, that's obviously off limits, can't do. Now, whether or not a Ouija board is legit, that's a different conversation. I tend to think no, it's a deceptive trick that, that we kind of, has predictable results. The Wizard of Oz, I think, I think the Wizard of Oz is pretty clear that the good witch, whatever, you know, she's not the same kind of thing as the bad witch, right? The bad witch does bad things. She wants death. And so we could say it's a fairy tale, right? She's, you know, call her whatever you want, a fairy, a pixie, a, you know, a cherubim. I mean, you could, just not to take it so seriously. Harry Potter, I think, is more complicated because you've got otherwise normal-ish people. They look like humans. They hang out with humans. But, oh, they're witches. And then they use their powers for, you know, sometimes questionable things. And so that raises up different levels. I certainly don't think that Christians have to like Harry Potter and have to all go out and be into Harry Potter. I'm reluctant to forbid it exclusively simply because of the subject matter. Because, of course, Narnia, I mean, the only thing that keeps the stuff in Narnia and The Lord of the Rings from being witchcraft is just they use a different name, right? Gandalf is a wizard. I mean, you know, Gandalf. And so, you know, Doug Wilson makes an argument that they're different because they're so obviously different universes, whereas Harry Potter is our universe. And so there could be something to that. I would...
not communicating with the dead, per se, which is what mostly the Torah is forbidding.
Yeah, and I think, that's a good point, too. You know, Gandalf in Lord of the Rings isn't doing the kinds of things that are forbidden.
He can make things move without touching them. Yeah, that
right.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I think that's a good observation, too. Yeah, we ought not have good characters that we're encouraging people to rally behind who are promoting sin. So that's a rule. And I think that's true, then, too, for our sort of Halloween practices. I mean, if you're dressing up like a witch to be goofy and everyone's laughing at you and that's all it is, right? So if somebody else is dressed up like the Easter Bunny, then I'm not that worried. If you dress up like a witch, you're like, now let me use my crystal ball and we're really going to talk to somebody, or like some of our Halloween festivities sometimes do, then I think, yeah, that's bad. That's a bad idea. Shouldn't do it. Stay away. I think there's a little bit of prudence there, deciding when it's silly, it's dress up, and nobody believes in any of it. Nobody's taking it seriously, and then all of a sudden, wait a minute, we've turned a corner here, and it really seems like we're enjoying being bad.
Yeah, and I think also prudence comes into if that is a particular temptation of the person.
Because you know we don't forbid people to be the bad guy in a play, right? You know, I'm a robber. I'm robbing a bank. But in the course of the play, it's clear he's the bad guy, and he's getting judged. And so that's one level. So if you're a witch and it's just goofy and no one's saying we're really doing this, or it's good to be a witch, or it's good to do these things, then it's not, I don't think, the big problem on our hands. But if we're using entertainment and humor to then make sinful things attractive, then we have a problem. sense, right? And if we're using sin, if we're using humor and entertainment to make it ridiculous that you would ever believe that these sinful things could be a problem, then that's a problem.
That's probably one of my
and I think that's probably the relevant problem, right? We use goofiness and humor and make-believe to persuade people that there's nothing to be concerned about. And that is a danger that we ought to be on guard against. And I think we all feel that, right? I mean, if someone came to you and said they talked to a ghost, you'd say, get out of here, shut up, that's stupid, right? But if they really believe they talked to a ghost, you need to be, you don't have to believe that they did, but you need to be concerned about what's going on, that they would be trying to do this and think that they did it. You know, that's a real problem. So, yeah, that would be my main pastoral advice, is sort of not to allow festivities to persuade us that righteousness and sin are not issues to take seriously. So, let's close in prayer. Dear God, we thank you for your word, even the difficult and strange portions, but we thank you we have the time to wrestle with them, to ask good questions, to seek to grow in our knowledge and understanding. Teach us by this word. Bless us in our pursuit of knowledge. May we not follow after the example of Saul and those others who do evil, but direct us to your true word and to follow the revelation you have given us through your Son and through your Scriptures. We pray that we would be faithful to them. In Jesus' name, amen.